It's a pleasure to be here. It's always great to interact with the group. What I'm going to be talking about is based on a whole sort of program and perspective that I've been building up for a number of years now. This program started back in 2019 with the publication of this paper, and it's grown over time in collaboration with some great people, some further work on my own, and most recently I've been working in collaboration with Sam Cree, who's a graduate student here now. What I'm going to say is sort of drawing on this whole program, but the technical results will be most closely related to this upcoming work with Sam. Okay, so I'm going to start out super generally by reminding you of one way that many people like to think about quantum information, which is that it's a theory that starts with a set of rules given to it by some area in physics, in this case, quantum mechanics, and then asking, subject to those rules, how can information be processed? From this perspective, it's natural to ask about other areas in physics which also have implications for information processing. So for example, relativity gives us the no signaling principle, which says that you can't send information faster than the speed of light. And beyond that, in say quantum gravity, we think that there are additional constraints on information processing, but we understand them less well. So for example, there's a very important conjecture called the covariant entropy bound. And what this says roughly is that the amount of entropy that can pass into some space-time region is bounded above by the area of that region. Okay. So if that's true, that's again some kind of non-trivial information processing constraint. So what I think this and the other example makes clear is that if we want to understand the physics underlying information, quantum mechanics is not the end of the story. And instead, if we want to understand this from a more fundamental perspective, since we think that our universe is described by some kind of a theory of quantum gravity, we should really think about the physics of quantum gravity and ask what its consequences are for information processing. And so that's the kind of question that I want to try and address in this talk today. Another point here is that because we don't understand quantum gravity super well, I think it's also important to step back a little bit and ask what is even the right framework within which to try and address this question? And is there even a precise framework in which we can ask this? And I'll try and address that today as well. Okay. So one big picture idea that I'll try and emphasize today and that I hope you'll take away from this talk is that at least for a special class of spacetimes, which are called holographic spacetimes, we can actually translate questions about quantum information with gravity into other questions about quantum information without gravity. That this translation is possible is a bit of a miracle, and I'll try and explain how that miracle comes about. But the most important thing for us is just that it's going to let us turn these sort of interesting but unfamiliar questions about quantum information in the presence of gravity into other more familiar questions. Okay, so a little more specifically, the question that I want to address about quantum information in the presence of gravity has to do with sort of the fundamental limits of computation. And more specifically, I want to think about some kind of finite space-time regions. I'm going to imagine some quantum systems coming in, some computation happening inside the region, and some quantum systems coming out. And then what I want to know is what transformations can relate the input to the output systems. Is it just all quantum channels, as would be implied by quantum mechanics alone? Or are there additional constraints that come up when we think about the physics of quantum gravity? Okay. So towards understanding that, and in accordance with this kind of an idea, I'm going to argue that you can turn that question into a different one about what's called a non-local quantum computation. And specifically, it's going to turn into a non-gravitational question about how much entanglement is required in one of these non-local quantum computations. Okay. So something else I think is worth emphasizing is that non-local quantum computation is in itself a very interesting and rich subject in information theory. And there's a number of reasons we might be interested in it, aside from this connection to gravity that I'm emphasizing here. So for example, it was first studied in the context of what's called position-based cryptography, where you're trying to verify somebody's location in space. And after that, it was also realized that there's some interesting connections to both classical and quantum complexity theory. So the technical results I'll give today will be about better understanding non-local quantum computation. And one of the things that those results will do is deepen this connection to complexity theory. And another thing that those results will do is reveal a new connection to a different subject, which is quantum secret sharing. Okay. So in the talk, I'm going to start with the more gravity side of the story. I'm going to try and explain this question in a bit more detail and explain how we can do this translation into a non-gravitational question. And then in the later part of the talk, I'm just going to focus on non-local quantum computation. And when I do that, I'll try and explain these various connections to complexity and cryptography and secret sharing, as well as how those connections tie back into this gravity side of the story. I guess there's a question.
I have a question.
Yes.
I ask about if quantum information deal with theories which depend on hidden local variables.
That's a little bit outside the scope of what I'm talking about today, so maybe we can bring that up back at the end.
Okay.
I'll just shelve that for now. Thanks. Okay, so right. So I'm going to start out, as I said, with the gravity side of the story. So let me explain the question here in a little bit more detail. So what we're interested in is we have some space-time region. Here it's this diamond. We have some quantum systems coming in, some quantum systems coming out. I want to know which transformations can relate the inputs and the outputs. To put this in a bit of context, this has been thought about before in the literature. Most famously, Seth Lloyd back in 2000 thought about this kind of question, and he argued that the physics of gravity would constrain the complexity, and he had in mind the circuit complexity, of what could happen inside of this region. His argument was pretty simple. So he assumed just the ordinary rules of quantum mechanics plus one additional piece of data from gravitational physics. So the one additional thing he wanted to use was just that the energy inside the region would be bounded above by the energy of a black hole with the same radius. Okay. With those two pieces, just quantum mechanics plus this bound, he argued that there would be an upper bound on the complexity of what you could do inside the region. The argument looks sort of plausible and is kind of interesting, but unfortunately it turns out to be wrong. So under the same set of assumptions, Stephen Jordan in 2017 gave a counterexample. So he showed how you could do that finite energy arbitrarily complex unitaries arbitrarily quickly. Okay. So an important caveat there though is that neither of these constructions are in the full context of quantum gravity, right? They're just assuming quantum mechanics plus this one piece of gravitational data. And so they ignore, you know, important physical constraints, like say the no signaling principle or this conjectured covariant entropy bound and so on. So given that it's not clear, I think, and actually maybe plausible, that gravity might still constrain the complexity of what can happen inside the region. So that's one suggestion that's out there. And one thing that I'll try and explore as I dig into this question in a bit more detail. Okay, so I'm going to try and specify this question in a more precise way so that we can get a handle on it. To do that, the first thing we want to do is be careful about how we're defining the space-time region of interest. So I'm going to call the region in which the computation happens J, and I'm going to require that J always be constructed via a particular procedure. So the procedure is we're going to pick four points in space-time, which will be C0, C1, R0, and R1. And we're going to define J by intersecting light cones of these four points. So I've drawn an example of this on the right. This is a space-time picture. So we have time going upwards and the position going horizontally. And then we have, say, this first point, C0. What I do is I look at its causal future, right? So that's this, this cone in here. And then I look at C1, I look at its causal future. I look at R0 and I take its past, R1 and I take its past. I intersect all those four regions, and that constructs for me this diamond here that I'm calling J. A region constructed in that way, I'm going to call a scattering region, and I'm always going to focus on computations that happen inside of a scattering region. Okay. The next step to making to phrasing this question a bit more precisely is I'm going to be careful about where the input systems start and where the output systems end up. Okay, so specifically, I'm going to require input system A0 start near the point C0 and A1 start near C1. Okay, so then those systems, they can come into the scattering region. Some kind of process happens. And then I'm going to require the output systems end up out at R1 and R0. Okay, so this is just a minor rephrasing of the question, but it actually removes a number of ambiguities and is important as we move forward. Okay. The next thing I want to do to understand this question better is I'm going to go to some kind of a setting where we have something of a handle on quantum gravity, right? This is really a question about quantum gravity. We need some sort of theory of quantum gravity. What we're going to make use of is ADS-CFT. So if you don't know anything about ADS-CFT, that's okay. You should be able to get away with just what I'm going to describe on this slide. So, okay, what is ADS-CFT? Well, it's a statement of equivalence of two apparently very different looking physical theories. On one side of the equivalence, we have quantum gravity in a special kind of a space-time called an asymptotically ADS space. That's what I've drawn as this cylinder here. Okay. On the other side of the equivalence, we have a special kind of field theory called a conformal field theory that lives in the boundary of my ADS space. So I've taken my cylinder, I've unrolled the boundary, cut it open, and that's this rectangle over here. So you should always think of these sides as being identified. Okay. One word just about nomenclature. So the gravity side, the ADS side of this equivalence, I'm going to refer to as the bulk, and the CFT side of this equivalence, I'm just going to refer to as the boundary, okay, just for shortness. Okay, a couple of things to know about how this equivalence works. First I should say, what do I mean by an equivalence? What I mean is any quantity you might want to know about on the ADS side in the bulk, say the outcome of some experiment or the area of some surface or correlation function or whatever you would like, you can in principle find out by doing some kind of calculation in the conformal field theory. And the reverse is also true. So if I want to measure some or determine some correlation function in the conformal field theory, there's in principle some calculation I can do in the quantum gravity theory to find that out. Okay, so a couple of things about how this equivalence works. The first is that on the ADS side, we have a dynamical geometry. So we have gravity. That means we can have all kinds of interesting gravitational physics happen, like a black hole can form, or a gravity wave could propagate, or a planet can orbit around a star, or whatever you'd like. In contrast, in the boundary, we're on a fixed geometry, and apparently there's no gravity. Despite this, somehow the conformal field theory describes all of the gravitational physics happening in your ADS space. So this is part of the power of ADS-CFT, right? Is that it gives me a description within just the framework of quantum mechanics of all this gravitational physics. It's limited to a special kind of space-time, but it's still very interesting that you can do that. Okay. The second thing is that on the quantum gravity side, we don't just have gravitational physics, we can also have quantum mechanical degrees of freedom. So for example, I could have, you know, a spin 1/2 system sitting in my bulk somewhere. I could also, in principle, construct some kind of quantum computer sitting in my bulk, and so on. So the point here is that I can think about quantum information processing tasks, computations, whatever you would like, happening inside of my ADS space. And those information processing tasks happen in a gravitating background. They happen in a dynamical space-time. Okay. And then in the conformal field theory, we get a description of that information processing task that happens with gravity in terms of just some non-gravitational description. Okay. And that's the basic thing that we're going to use to turn quantum information with gravity questions into quantum information without gravity questions. Okay. The last thing is just that sort of obvious, but worth emphasizing, the bulk side of this equivalence is one higher dimensional than the boundary side, right? So in particular, I have the time direction going up in this kind of picture. I have a radial spatial direction coming out like this. And then I also have some angular direction, right? In the conformal field theory, there's no radial direction. There's only this angular direction, okay? That makes it extra surprising that the conformal field theory can describe everything that's happening in the bulk, but it's nonetheless true and is the origin of this name, holographic. So a space-time that can be described this way, in terms of a theory that lives at its boundary, we call a holographic space-time. That's the kind of space-time I'm going to focus on in this talk. Okay, good. All right, so that's the setting we're going to use. So now let's go and ask our question in the setting. Specifically, we want to know about computations happening inside these scattering regions. So let's construct our scattering region in one of these holographic space-times. To do that, like I described, we pick these four points, right? C0, C1, R0, and R1. And then we intersect their future and past light cones, and that constructs for us some scattering region, which I'm calling J. In the example I've drawn, J happens to be one point. I've done that for simplicity. In general, it will be some extended sort of a region with some kind of shape to it. Okay. If you aren't a huge fan of this kind of a space-time picture, you can also just think in terms of this schematic picture that I've shown on the right. So the schematic is just meant to capture the essential causal features of how the computation happens, right? So we have these locations where the inputs start out. They come together inside the scattering region. Whatever computation happens inside the scattering region, I've signified with this yellow dot here. And then the outputs come out to R0 and to R1. Okay, good. One comment here is that when I chose these four points, I was careful in the space-time picture to choose them at the edge of the cylinder, all the way off at the boundary. That's going to help me identify what this looks like from the boundary perspective. Okay. Oh, sorry. One more thing I should say is that a computation that happens in this form, where the inputs come together and interact directly, I'm going to call a local computation. Okay, so now I want to think about what is the description of that local computation in the boundary picture, right? So we have two equivalent descriptions of the same physics. There's some description of how this computation happens in the boundary. To understand that, I've drawn the boundary geometry here, right? So that's this strip I'd drawn before. And then because I picked my four points off at the edge of my cylinder, I can naturally identify those points with points in the boundary. Right, so now I have the same four points, C0, C1, R0, R1, okay. Because the boundary describes all of the physics in the bulk, it will also be true that I have the same input and output systems and they hold the same quantum information. So I have some system here, A0 coming in, A1, B0, and B1. In the boundary description, the transformation relating the inputs and outputs will be the same one as in the bulk description, okay? So the same computation happens, and what I wanna do is try and understand how does it happen? What does this process look like? The important thing to notice here is that while in the bulk description, we could bring the input systems together and interact them directly, in the boundary, it's not possible to do that. And it's not possible to do that just because we have one less dimension. Right? So the way this plays out is if I say try to bring together A0 and A1, and I brought them together here, now I can get my output to R0, but I can't get it to R1. And similarly, if I try to bring A0 and A1 together here, then I can get out to R1, but not to R0. It's just outside my causal future. Okay. So what that means is that this is not the right description of how the computation happens. It doesn't happen locally here. Instead, I claim that the way to understand how the computation happens is in terms of a schematic that looks like this on the right. So here, there's a few important features I should point out. One is that we start out with some state on V0, V1 that starts out shared between the left and the right. So there's a quantum system V0 here and a system V1 here. And then what happens is A0 and V0 interact in some computation. V1 and A1 are interacted. Then there's a round of communication, okay, a single simultaneous round of communication. And then another set of computations happens on each side, right? That's the second set of yellow dots. And then at the end of that, the same quantum systems, B0 and B1, should be produced. Okay. Computations that happen in this form, with interactions on each side, a round of communications, and then interactions on each side, I'm calling a non-local quantum computation. Okay, so this is what I meant when I was mentioning this at the beginning. I mean something that happens in precisely this form. Okay. So the punchline of the last two slides is that all the computations that can happen inside of this finite gravitating region, the scattering region, must be reproduced in this boundary description in the non-local form. Okay. And the way that I want to think of this is some kind of a constraint on what computations can happen inside of the region. So we're constrained to only implement things inside the region that can also be implemented non-locally. To understand that constraint in a little more detail, I want to make it quantitative. And in particular, I'm going to point out the relevant quantity, the relevant number in the bulk description and in the boundary description. So in the bulk description, what we're interested in is the area of the scattering region. So I've drawn a scattering region here in its extended form. So when it's not a point, this is what it looks like. This is a bit hard to see. It's a tetrahedron. It has four sides. The four faces of the tetrahedron are related to the four light cones of these four points. The details aren't super important. What is important is that there's a privileged surface that's picked out on this scattering region, which is this lower edge here. And it's that thing's area that I'm interested in. I'm going to call that A sub R. Okay. In the non-local picture, in the boundary picture, the quantity that I'm interested in is the amount of correlation in this state that starts out shared between the left and the right. Okay. And in particular, I'm going to look at the mutual information. So that state on V0, V1, that's a state of the degrees of freedom in the conformal field theory. And you can actually do some calculation in the conformal field theory to work out what that mutual information is. If you do that, what you find is that the mutual information in that state is of the same order as the area of that surface on the bottom of the scattering region. Okay, so then our quantitative refinement of this constraint is that anything that's computable inside of a scattering region of some area A must be computable non-locally using a resource state with mutual information of order A. Okay. So the intuition here, right, is that as I get a larger and larger region, I have a larger area, I can compute more things inside the region. And as I have more and more correlation in this non-local picture, I can do more and more computations. And then the statement that ADSCF is telling us is that those numbers have to scale in the same way. Okay.
Alex, can I ask a question?
Yes, go for it.
So V0 and V1 are like space time region, yeah, on the boundary, right?
I didn't say explicitly, but they are. So V0 is this diamond here. Mm-hmm. V1 is this diamond here.
So the statement is like, if such a scattering looks like possible from the bulk perspective, then there should be like a Cauchy slice, boundary slice, which where the mutual information becomes large.
So the mutual information is independent of which slice you take. Like, in fact, in quantum field theory, when you define, say, the von Neumann entropy, you really mean the von Neumann entropy of one of these diamonds, not just of a slice. So if I have a diamond, the entropy on any slice is all the same. And so you should really think of it as defined on the diamond, not on the slice.
I see.
Yeah, so,
and when you say area, which area AR is something? Yeah.
Yeah. So I haven't fully described the geometry of this region, but there's, yeah, this scattering region has some kind of a shape. It's this tetrahedron. This surface on the bottom here, that's the area that I mean. If you want to be more precise, the way that you define that surface is it would be the future of C0, the boundary of the future of C0 intersected with the boundary of the future of C1, intersected with the past of R0 and the past of R1. So that's R in general relativistic language. The important thing about it is that that thing's area.
Okay, area means like in this example, 2 plus 1b ADS.
Oh, it means the length of this line.
Length and right, but is there any area that directly corresponds to mutual information, or you are just saying it's kind of order of AR? Or?
Yeah, so when you do the calculation, I mean, so if I want to calculate this mutual information, mm-hmm. I could do that in the CFT, or I haven't introduced this yet, but I know Benny's familiar, so I'll use it anyhow.
if you explain it later, then.
Yeah. So the mutual information, one thing we know about ADS-CFT is that it will be the difference in, it'll be this area plus this area minus this area. So 1, 2, 3, 4. So it would be the area of 1 plus the area of 2 minus the area of 3 minus the area of 4. On the relativistic side, you can use tools from classical general relativity to relate that area difference to the area of this surface along the bottom here.
In this example, what's AR like roughly? In this example of like V0, V1 with this 1, 2, 3.
Yeah. So the only statement I'm making is that they're the same area. So AR will, mm-hmm. or same order. So AR will be of the same mm-hmm. order as this difference. It turns out that in the vacuum state, they're actually equal. But in general, they're just of the same order.
I see. Oh, so it's really equal. I see.
For the vacuum. Yeah, in the vacuum, it's equal. Yeah.
I see. Okay, thanks.
Okay, yeah. Sorry, there's details that I'm hiding, like GR calculations that I'm hiding, but yeah. So let me just like step back a little bit and think about what we did here in the bigger picture. So we had some kind of a question about quantum information processing in a gravitating background. And then to address this, we did a few things. So the first is we narrowed the scope of our question to asking it in the context of one of these holographic spacetimes, right? And two, we made sure to ask the question in a sort of boundary anchored way. So the inputs to the to the information processing task, to the inputs to the computation started at the boundary and went out to the boundary again. Because we phrased the question in that way, we're able to identify a corresponding question in the conformal field theory, in the boundary description, and that won't involve gravity, okay? So the point here is that that process of reasoning, I can repeat for other questions, right? So if I have other questions about quantum information in the context of gravity, I can go through the same routine and turn it into a non-gravitational boundary question. Okay, so I think this is a pretty general tool to try and understand quantum information in the presence of gravity. I focused on one question here for this talk. It's the one I've thought about the most, but I think there's many other things you could ask. Okay, another comment here is that this same perspective of thinking about quantum information processing in this sort of operational way from both the bulk ADS perspective and the boundary perspective and relating those two things can be used for other purposes. So one thing that I've been doing with this is just studying the ADS-CFT correspondence itself. In particular, the kind of statement that you learn has to do with relationships between measures of correlation, entanglement in the conformal field theory, and relating those to features of the geometry of the bulk space. Okay. Another thing that you can do with this is it turns out you can also just learn new statements, new theorems about classical general relativity in these ADS space times. So this is nice because you can forget about the conformal field theory and the boundary description and so on, and you just learn something about classical GR. Okay, so those are two other directions that you can take this and that I've been working on in other work, but that I'm not going to discuss further today, and I just wanted to mention them because they're closely related and use a similar set of tools. Okay, good. Okay, so now I want to come back to just focusing on this thread of non-local quantum computation. I try and have various points in the talk where if you've gotten lost, you can jump back in. This is one such point. Okay, so let me summarize sort of where we're at. We're viewing computation from two different perspectives. We're thinking about computations that happen in this local picture where the inputs interact directly. And then in this non-local picture that is of this form I'm showing on the right. We're interested in how computations in this non-local perspective can reproduce what happens in the local perspective. The basic technical question that I want to ask about this is, what is the property of the local computation, right? Say the channel is N. What is the property of that channel that controls the entanglement cost needed to implement it in the non-local form? Okay. The basic suggestion there that I want to explore is that it could be some measure of the complexity of this channel that controls the entanglement cost. The reason to think about this, or there's two reasons to think about this. One is that that kind of relationship is already suggested by existing upper bounds in the literature. So in particular, there's explicit methods that are known in the literature for doing computations non-locally. And in those constructions, it turns out that the entanglement cost will be controlled by some kind of a measure of the complexity of the thing you're doing. Okay, so that's one reason. The other reason is that if this is true, so if complexity really does control entanglement, then it would actually imply Lloyd's idea that gravity constrains complexity, right? Because we said that computations in this region are limited to be those that can be implementable non-locally with a given amount of entanglement. If entanglement controls complexity, then the complexity in the region gets constrained and in particular controlled by its area. Okay. So that's the thing I want to explore. The way I'm going to do that is I'm going to start with just a simple example. So the example is of implementing a Clifford unitary, right? Always good to start with Cliffords. And in particular, the Clifford is going to act on n qubits, so n k-dimensional quantum systems. And by a Clifford, I don't quite just mean the usual thing, but I mean something in the normalizer of the Pauli group that's been generalized to act on k-dimensional systems, right? So just a generalized Clifford in this sense. And then I want to think about the entanglement cost and the complexity. So on the entanglement side, it turns out there's a simple protocol for doing these Cliffords in a non-local form. And the resource that you need or that you can use is n copies of the maximally entangled state on two qubits. Okay. So then the mutual information would be n times log k. Okay, so that's the entanglement side. On the complexity side, what we're going to do is think about the complexity of measuring one qubit of output from a Clifford circuit. Okay, it turns out that the complexity class that captures how hard that is this class called mod KL. Okay, so that result is something that Sam and I prove in this upcoming paper. The case for K equals 2 was proven already by Aronson and Gottesman some time ago, so we're just generalizing that proof. Okay. Mod KL is a pretty obscure complexity class, so you probably haven't heard of it before. That's okay. If you haven't heard of it before, just take it to be defined by what I'm saying here. So take it to be the set of all problems that you can solve by running a Clifford circuit and then measuring one Qkit of output. Okay. Something you do need to know about it though, is that it sits between the classes L and P. So what that means is if I have a Turing machine, right, that I can run for a polynomial number of time steps, then I can determine the outcome of running this Clifford circuit, right? Mod KL is inside of P. On the other hand, if I have a Turing machine that's constrained to use only logarithmic memory, then I cannot determine the outcome of this Clifford circuit. So that's means that L is smaller than mod KL. Okay. We, in fact, have very strong evidence to think that L is strictly contained in mod KL and mod KL is strictly contained in P. Okay, good. Okay, so this is our example. We know the entanglement, we know the complexity. And then the idea here is that we're gonna say, suppose that this complexity controlling entanglement idea is true. Then as a consequence, it should be true that for any computation I try and do non-locally, if the complexity is inside of mod KL or smaller, it should be possible to do it non-locally with a polynomial amount of entanglement. So here it was linear and I'm only requiring polynomial because I'm going to allow this relationship between complexity and entanglement to be relaxed a little bit and allow for polynomial overheads. But the basic idea is that since I can get away with low entanglement in this, for this complexity class, in this specific example, if complexity controls entanglement, that should always be the case. So that's our sort of hypothesis. It's a consequence of this complexity control.
Alex, I got a bit lost. So can I? So idea or conjecture or the claim is what? Like, yeah. I have a poly-N neutral information, then we can do any Clifford. Am I correct? Or
that we can do any computation whose complexity is inside the class mod KL, which in particular includes the Cliffords.
Okay.
But would also include other things.
Good. Right. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. So what we want to do is test this complexity controls entanglement idea by testing this consequence of it, by looking at some other computation I can do non-locally and trying to see if I can do everything with complexity mod KL in poly entanglement. Okay. So the example I'm going to use is what's called F routing. So here, a particular F routing computation is defined by some choice of function called F, which maps from strings of length 2n to just bits. Okay. And then the inputs to the computation are a string x on the left of length n, a quantum system of some dimension d on the left, and a string of length n on the right, call it y. Okay, those are the inputs. And then as outputs, what you need to produce as from the computation is you need to bring the quantum system q to the side labeled by f. So if fxy evaluates to zero, you need to bring q to the left. And if fxy evaluates to one, you need to bring q to the right. Okay. So then what we're interested in is how much entanglement does it require? Do we need to do that non-locally for different functions now? This particular non-local quantum computation is actually the best studied one in the literature because it's of particular interest in the context of this position-based cryptography idea that I mentioned earlier. In that context, doing this task non-locally corresponds to cheating in these cryptographic scenarios. So in that way, people are interested in understanding how much entanglement does this require because how much entanglement it requires controls how hard it is to cheat in those scenarios. Okay. So this F routing task has been been studied before, in particular by these authors. And these authors introduced what is currently the most efficient protocol for doing this F-routing task non-locally. What they found is that in their protocol, which is called the garden hose protocol, the entanglement cost is controlled by 2 to the memory cost to compute F on a Turing machine. So this is interesting to us, right? Because we're interested in the relationship between complexity and entanglement. And at least within the context of this protocol, we see that there's a very close relationship in that the entanglement cost is just controlled directly by the space complexity of this function F. Okay, so we were interested in what can you do with polynomial entanglement. Here, if I want to just use polynomial entanglement, you want to restrict your memory to logarithmic. And so that means you can do functions in log space using poly entanglement. Okay. That's the most efficient protocol known in the literature. It's natural to ask, can we do better? Can we compute more functions than L using poly entanglement? Based on this idea that complexity controls entanglement that I'm exploring, we would expect yes, right? Because we said there that we should be able to do all functions in mod KL, and L is strictly inside of mod KL. Okay, so the garden hose is too weak, it doesn't do enough. Another reason that we might think that the garden hose isn't strong enough is that from going back to this gravity perspective, if log space was optimal, what that would mean is that when you try and do computations inside of the scattering region, you're constrained to use an amount of memory that's logarithmic in the area of this region. So my intuition was that this is much too small. I can't give you a great reason for that because we don't understand quantum gravity super well. But nonetheless, my intuition was that this was too small. And indeed, this was actually the first reason that I started thinking about how you might improve on these kind of protocols. If we think that we can improve, you can ask, how could we improve? What sort of tools could we introduce to do better? And there we can draw a little bit of inspiration from the gravity side. So in ADS-CFT, a very important element of how quantum information comes into ADS-CFT is quantum error correction, okay? So a natural tool to introduce here, since we also know that ADS-CFT does non-local quantum computation in the boundary, is to think about how can we use quantum error correction in the context of non-local quantum computation. Okay, so that's what we're gonna try. to start exploring this, I'm just gonna start with a really simple example. Okay, so here in the example, X and Y are just gonna be single bits. They're each just 0 or 1. And then the function that we wanna do the F routing task for is just going to be the AND function of those 2 bits. So it's going to be X and Y. Okay. Then what we're going to do is we're going to take Q and record it into an error correcting code. It's going to be a really simple error correcting code with 3 shares that corrects 1 erasure error. Okay. So I've called those S1, S2, and S3. Okay. Then I'm going to specify the protocol here by just telling you what to do with each of these 3 shares. For the first share, S1, what you're going to do is just always keep S1 on the left. So Q starts out on the left, the encoding happens on the left, S1 starts out on the left, just leave it there. So I've drawn this table in the bottom left, summarizing what happens to each of the shares. So we can see that in all cases, regardless of the inputs, S1 started out on the left, or ends up on the left, rather. Okay, now let's think about share S2. What we're going to do there is always bring S2 to the side labeled by X. So if X is 0, bring S2 to the left. If X is 1, bring S2 to the right. We can do this because X starts out on the left, S2 is on the left, and we have this round of communication where we can choose to send S2 or to keep it, right? So we're exploiting that. Okay, next, or finally, for the share S3, we're going to send S3 to the side labeled by Y. Okay, that's a little bit trickier because S3 starts out on the left, and Y starts out on the right. The way that I'll get around that is by using some entanglement. So I take S3, I measure it in the Bell basis with some entangled state. I end up with S3 up to a poly correction on the right-hand side. Then that quantum system on the right, I send to the side labeled by Y. Right now it's in the same place as Y and I can make that decision. Meanwhile, I got some measurement outcome here on the left, call it I, which I'm going to send to the left and to the right. It's classical, I can copy it, I just send it to both. So then wherever S3 primed ends up, I can use I to undo the poly correction and just end up with the corrected system on the correct side. Okay, so the table summarizes what's happened here. S1's always on the left, S2 is on the left when X is zero. S3 is on the left when Y is zero, and then similarly for the right. Okay, so what is this done? Remember that in the error correcting code, we can correct one erasure error. So whoever gets two out of the three shares recovers Q. In the first three cases, the person on the left has two out of the three shares and gets Q. That's what we wanted, because in those first three cases, the and, X and Y, comes out to be zero, and that's the case where we want Q on the left. So it's working correctly. In the last case, we have two shares on the right, so we get Q on the right. And indeed, that's exactly the case where X and Y comes out to be one, right? And so that's what we wanted. We wanted Q on the right. Okay, so that was pretty detailed. But the overall strategy here of what's happening is we are using this structure in the error correcting code, in particular, the pattern of which subsets recover Q and which do not. And we're matching that structure to the function that we want to do this computation for, and then exploiting that to complete the computation, right? So we just needed the structure in this code to match this function somehow. Okay, so that basic idea we can generalize, and I'm going to explain how to generalize it. It's slightly more technical. You'll just be able to take away the punchline if you get lost, but I'll try and give some sense of how this works. So it turns out that the right tool to generalize is not quite just quantum error correction, but something a little more detailed or specific, which is quantum secret sharing. So let me describe how quantum secret sharing works a little bit. So in quantum secret sharing, we have our logical system, which in this context is called the secret, okay? We take the secret and we encode it into some set of shares, which I'm gonna call S1 through SN. Different secret sharing schemes will have different pattern of which subsets recover Q and which do not. To capture that structure, I'm going to make a couple definitions. So the first definition is I'm going to label all the possible subsets of S1 through SN using strings of length n. So the subset K of Z is defined to be all those shares S sub I such that Z sub I is 1. That's slightly hard to parse when I say it out loud, but it's straightforward. So it just means, for instance, that this K acting on the string 101 would be the subset S1 and S3, right? Because the first and third bits are one. Okay. The next thing I need is what's called the indicator function. So the indicator function is defined on strings of length n, and it's defined to be zero if you learn nothing about the quantum system Q from the corresponding subset K of Z, and to be one if you can recover Q from the subset K of Z. Okay, so the indicator function captures this structure of which subsets recover Q and which don't. One comment is that not all functions can be realized as indicator functions for some secret sharing scheme. Indicator functions have certain constraints that they have to satisfy as a consequence of some, you know, constraints on secret sharing coming just from quantum mechanics. Okay, so that's the structure of quantum secret sharing schemes. How can we exploit that in the context of this F-routing idea? When we can use this is, suppose that we want to do the F-routing task for a function F that happens to be the indicator function for some quantum secret sharing scheme. Then what I do is I use a protocol almost the same as this one, this simple one, but I replace this simple quantum error correcting code with the quantum secret sharing scheme that has F, the sort of target function, as its indicator function. If I do that and I play this same game of sending shares labeled to sides labeled by bits, then that will actually complete the F routing task for you. Okay. In that kind of a protocol, if you think about how much entanglement you use, it turns out that the entanglement for F routing there is bounded above by what's called the size of the quantum secret sharing scheme. The size is just the sum of the number of qubits in all the shares. And in quantum secret sharing, something that you usually want to minimize, like what makes a secret sharing scheme good, is trying to minimize the size. Okay, so what this is telling us is that we have a lower bound on how good of a quantum secret sharing you can make coming from this non-local quantum computation side. Okay, I see there's a raised hand. Green?
I ask about if the mapping between any value x or y and its image is the processing itself or not. I ask about the mapping in routing if x and y.
I don't think I understand your question. So you're asking about the mapping from x and y to the function or?
To its image, to its function, x and y, f x and y.
Yeah, so f of x and y is just some, that's just some Boolean value. It's either 0 or 1, and that's indicating whether we want to end up on the left and the right.
I ask about the speed of mapping. The mapping f between the element and its image. I don't mean speed meter per second, but I mean the rate of change, the rate some quantity. I ask about the mapping and the processing itself.
I think what you're asking may be addressed partly on the next slide. So maybe I'll just keep going, and you can bring this up again at the end of the talk if you have more questions.
Okay.
Thank you. So this is the relationship that I hinted at the beginning between non-local computation and quantum secret sharing. We see that non-local computation lower bounds the size of these secret sharing schemes. Okay. So we were interested, though, in this section more about the relationship between entanglement and complexity. So let's try and get back to there. Here, we can actually use or sort of piggyback on a known existing relationship between quantum secret sharing and complexity. So in particular, there's a very beautiful construction due to Adam Smith back in 2000, who constructed an interesting class of quantum secret sharing schemes. So he showed that for a given indicator function, call it F sub I, you can construct a quantum secret sharing scheme with size given by the size of what's called a span program that computes F. So a span program is some kind of a model of computation, and its size is some measure of the resources used in that model of computation. So the span program size is some kind of a measure of complexity. Okay. starting from that and adding a few tricks, it turns out that you can move from doing F routing for just indicator functions to actually arbitrary functions. So in particular, what happens is that you can do the F routing task with an entanglement cost for some function F, upper bounded by the size of a span program that computes F. Okay, so we were in particular interested in what functions I could compute with polynomial entanglement. And here we're seeing that's at least those functions with polynomial size span programs. As it happens, it turns out that functions with polynomial size span programs are exactly the functions in the class mod KL. That's one way to define mod KL. Okay, so that's very interesting because it does two things for us. So one is it brings us into alignment with this expectation we had based on the idea that complexity controls entanglement, right? So we said, if complexity controls entanglement, feeding in this example of the Cliffords, we should be able to do F-routing with polyentanglement for at least those functions in mod KL. And with this new construction, we can get exactly that. Okay, so to some extent, that supports this idea that complexity controls entanglement. Okay. The other thing it does for us is remember that in the garden hose protocol, which is previously the most efficient one in the literature, in that protocol, we could do functions in log space using polyentanglement. And now we can do mod KL. And I said that mod KL is strictly bigger than L. And so that shows we can do now more functions with polyentanglement. That means that this code-based idea is now the most efficient non-local computation for this F-routing task in the literature. And in particular, it's now the most efficient attack on these position-based cryptography schemes that are based on F-routing. Okay, good. Okay, so that section was all about new protocols and exploring this relationship between complexity and entanglement. Now I want to switch gears a little bit. And instead of thinking about upper bounds on how much entanglement you use, instead think about lower bounds, requirements on entanglement. Here, I'm not going to provide any new lower bounds. I just want to make some comments about what the consequences are of lower bounds for both the gravity side of the story and this complexity side. Okay, so starting with the gravity side, it's interesting to recall this covariant entropy bound that I mentioned all the way at the beginning. And in particular, so the covariant entropy bound is some kind of a bound on how much entropy you can fit into some space-time region. And if we apply that to our scattering regions, so I have this tetrahedron here, which was our scattering region, I can apply it here. And in particular, I'll use the area of this lower edge here, R, that I was talking about before. Applied to that, what the covariant entropy bound tells me is that the entropy passing into my scattering region is bounded above by the area of that surface R, okay, up to some numerical constants. Using that, plus some results that that I proved with Jeff and John in this paper and then followed up on in this paper, you can relate that area to boundary quantities and in particular to the mutual information. And the outcome here is that you end up with an upper bound on the entropy passing into the region in terms of the mutual information. Okay, so you end up with an upper bound like this. The way that I'm thinking about this is as some kind of a constraint on what computations can happen inside the scattering region, right? So what it's saying is that the inputs to the computation cannot be too large. They can't be larger than this mutual information. Otherwise, they just somehow don't fit in the region. So that's a constraint on computation.
Alex, what was delta S actually?
Delta S is like, think of some qubits passing into the region here. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to be doing some computation, I should be allowed to have those qubits in any state. So say they're in a maximally entangled state with some reference.
Oh, I see. So the total entropy of the input stuff.
Yes. Yeah. It's the you can think of it as just the number of qubits going into the region.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. So that is some kind of a constraint on computation inside the region, and it's coming from assuming what we think we know about physics in the bulk. Okay. It's a conjectured bound, but this is what we think we know. So part of the perspective of this talk is that we should try and understand constraints on computation inside the region by using this non-local quantum computation perspective, using this boundary perspective, right? So a natural question is, can we recover this consequence of the covariant entropy bound from our perspective of non-local quantum computation? The answer there turns out to be interesting. It's almost. So you can almost recover this bound. In particular, the bound you can get looks like this. So it's of exactly the same form, but now we have this factor of 1/2 that makes it slightly weaker. Okay. An interesting comment here is that this bound comes from thinking about what's called a monogamy of entanglement game. So monogamy games might be familiar to people who think about, say, quantum key distribution. They're studied in the context of proving security of some key distribution schemes, but we can use them here. And an interesting observation is that if there exists a monogamy game, or actually you can relax what we mean by a monogamy game a little bit, but if there exists a game in this sort of family where the optimal strategy, the optimal success probability is no better than randomly guessing, then you get exactly this bound, right? So we know that the success probability will never be lower than randomly guessing. And if you can saturate that, then you get back this consequence of the CEB. Okay. So yeah, this to me is a very interesting coincidence. And I think definitely motivates thinking more about these monogamy of entanglement games and maybe hints that there could be some, you know, deeper connection in terms of actually maybe trying to prove the CEB from this kind of non-local game perspective. But that's, yeah, something I'm thinking about. Okay, so the next thing we could try and do, right, is we can say, okay, this bound is the best one you get by assuming what we think we know about gravity in the bulk. You can ask, what are, you know, could we prove anything stronger? So the first comment is that anything stronger than this, even if it's, you know, delta S log delta S or whatever, would present some kind of a novel constraint on quantum information in the presence of gravity that goes beyond, you know, what's even conjectured. What are our prospects for proving something like that from this boundary perspective, from this non-local computation perspective? I think it's totally plausible to be able to prove something like that. And it's definitely something I'm thinking about. But there are some caveats and things you have to keep in mind, or at least be careful of. So in particular, suppose that we think about this F-routing thing, and we try to prove a lower bound on the entanglement cost there that is like explicitly in terms of N, the input size. So in this context, you should think of delta S like N, the number of input bits or qubits. If you prove such a lower bound on entanglement cost, because of this code routing protocol I gave, that would also now provide a lower bound on the size of span programs. So proving lower bounds on the size of something like a span program is a pretty long-standing goal in complexity theory. And there has been a little bit of success, but it's been very limited, and it's quite a hard thing to do. So from one perspective, you could be an optimist and you could say, ah, maybe this connection to non-local computation is a really interesting way to try and prove these lower bounds in complexity theory. But if you're maybe a bit more pessimistic or perhaps realistic, you should say, okay, maybe this is not the kind of thing I want to try and prove. Maybe this is something that's too hard. Instead, I think that a better idea of the kind of thing you should try and prove is a lower bound on the entanglement cost in terms of some other measure of the complexity of this function. If that measure of complexity is not something that's explicitly computable, and if you choose it carefully, then it doesn't seem to prove anything that we think is really hard about complexity theory. And so this seems like a more plausible and realistic idea that would still have very interesting constraints or consequences on the gravity side. Okay, so that's everything I want to say about lower bounds. I'm almost done. I'm just going to wrap up with some summary and some final comments. First of all, let me just summarize the overall logic of this talk. So I started by saying, I want to think about quantum information in a gravitating space-time focused on holographic space-times, and then argued that this ADS-CFT correspondence lets me translate quantum information with gravity questions into quantum information without gravity questions. And I want to think of that as a sort of general framework for moving between these two things. Then more specifically, I thought about computations in a gravitating region and how they might be constrained. Using this kind of translation, we can turn that into questions about entanglement consumption in non-local quantum computation. specifically within that, what we wanted to think about was if it's the complexity that controls entanglement. Okay. There, I tried to argue that it is. And one thing that we did was to say, you know, if we look at this example of Clifford's, we can set up this expectation based on this complexity controls entanglement idea. And then going to other examples, we can verify that expectation. And yeah, we verified that by introducing this new code-based protocol. Okay. So this is, you know, one particular thread, I think, in sort of an interesting web of connections between quantum gravity, quantum information, complexity theory, secret sharing, monogamy games, all these nice subjects, position-based cryptography. So within that whole space, I think there's a lot of interesting directions to go. I'll try and point out a couple that I have in mind. So specifically towards understanding non-local quantum computation better, I think the most interesting and exciting target for me is to try and understand lower bounds on entanglement. So there, maybe the most immediate thing is to understand if we can recover this consequence of the covariant entropy bound, or maybe the entropy bound itself. There seems to be some kind of a route forward there in terms of better understanding these monogamy games. Okay, so this is one thing to do. And then beyond that, we can try and prove stronger bounds. And there, the route forward seems to be, you know, better understanding this relationship to complexity theory and being careful about, you know, what we think we can prove and what we think should be too hard to prove. Okay. On the other side of things, one can keep looking for still more efficient non-local quantum computation protocols. So here we improved some things from L log space to this larger class mod KL. We can ask if we can keep going. One idea there is that, you know, in this context, the way we made progress was by introducing quantum error correction. The inspiration for doing that was coming from this connection to ADS-CFT. We can ask, you know, are there additional features of ADS-CFT that we can try and bring into the fold here? And will they give us, you know, other or more improvements in the complexity of what we can do in non-local quantum computation? Okay. Stepping back a bit, we can also just think about this more general topic of quantum information in the presence of quantum gravity. And there, you know, I try to emphasize that there's this sort of general procedure you can do to move from a question about quantum information with gravity into one without gravity. And then we can ask, you know, in this non-gravitational picture, what problems does this then raise about quantum information and complexity and cryptography and so on? I think in the context of, you know, the one question that I've asked, it led to many interesting questions in the quantum information side. So I'm hopeful that, you know, repeating that procedure will end up with other interesting questions and more connections to other exciting areas and so on. Okay, so that's everything. Thank you. And I'll just leave up this this summary slide.
Thanks, Alex, for a great talk. So, time for questions, I guess. Any questions?
It looks like Charlie has a question.
Hi, thanks for the really interesting talk. I was wondering, I was trying to think more about these scattering regions and what would happen if maybe like a black hole or a part of a black hole was inside, you like caught part of the black hole inside the scattering region. What would that mean on the boundary point of view? Or is that kind of outside of this definition?
So if you form a black hole, then you know, the information comes out, but it comes out later. And so okay. I think what happens is that if you form a black hole, then you're then prevented from doing this computation inside the scattering region. And the way that this is, the way that this is enforced in the boundary perspective is that you can't put too much stuff inside the region because you'll violate this bound with the mutual information that I mentioned. So, I guess what I should say is, there's some kind of constraint on computation in the bulk picture that's coming from needing to not form a black hole. And the way that is enforced in the boundary is through this inequality, that delta S has to be less than the mutual information.
And the computation could still happen. It's just going to happen much later, which leaves the scattering region because that's kind of bounded in time as well. Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
Other questions? So I have one quick, any other question?
I muted myself when I was trying to ask the question, so maybe I'll ask first. So why do you consider entanglement as the complexity, first of all? Because that's only one aspect of the interaction. And second, is there any reason why you do not consider non-maximally entangled state to measure the entanglement in the interaction?
Okay, so the first question is, why am I focusing on the complexity? And there, you know, I think it may be some other feature of this local computation that controls the correlation you need in the boundary. The complexity is the thing I've been exploring, but, you know, I haven't reached any definitive conclusions there. I don't know that's true. I'm just preliminarily trying to construct an argument that that should be the case. It, you know, aligns with some expectation from the gravity side, like I was mentioning about Seth Lloyd's arguments. It also, you know, in the explicit protocols that we have that do non-local quantum computation, their entanglement cost is somehow controlled by some kind of a measure of complexity. So in my construction, that was span program size. In the garden hose, that was the memory on a Turing machine. There's other constructions that are about like T-gate depth, stuff like this. So yeah, somehow the complexity seems to keep coming up, and so I'm trying to explore that further. Sorry, your second question was about why am I focused on EPR pairs? Yeah, I'm not sure that I should be focused on EPR pairs. So, you know, I think my work here is pretty preliminary, and right now I've been looking at the mutual information, but you could wonder if, like, you know, if you need X amount of mutual information when you have a bunch of EPR pairs, but you need much less correlation if you have some other kind of entangled state. I think that's a very interesting possibility. I don't have any great insights into that yet, but you know, it's definitely worth exploring. If you know, is it really just say the mutual information that measures the usefulness of a state for doing non-local computation, or is there some more refined way of thinking about the entangled state that is controlling how useful it is? It's a good question, and I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'll quickly mention that if you consider performing non-local gates, non-maximally entangled state can make a big difference in the communication needed to simulate the gate. And communication structure is something that I mean, this is part of your scheme, but already like the backward forward communication and the entanglement, these are already quite a bit of trade-off to deal with. But one thing we particularly know is that you can require a lot more communication if you restrict to maximum entangled state. In that framework, which does not even have gravity, it's just flat quantum information. So
That's interesting. I mean, here the situation is a little bit different in that I'm not constraining the communication specifically, but that example does still, you know, show that it can be relevant and may also be relevant here. So it's a good one.
Other question? Yeah, just speak up. Marvin, no.
So, Namrata. Go ahead.
Hi, it was a great talk. Thank you.
Thanks.
So I, when you're defining J, the scattering region, when you define the input and outputs of the system, do you consider, like, do we think about it as if you're including causality in there? Or is it just an arbitrary flow that you had created to then work all of this out?
Well, I'm considering causality at the level of like outside the, so the region is defined causally, right? It's defined by intersecting the future and pasts of these points. So it's a causally defined region, but I'm not thinking about like any microscope, more like smaller grain details about the causal structure within this region.
Okay.
I'm taking a different perspective of saying, you know, what happens inside the region is some, could be in general, some high energy process. You might not even have a good description of space time there. Who knows what's going on? Let's instead go to the boundary picture where I just have, where instead I can think about this in the context, in the framework of this non-local quantum computation. So I'm trying to understand like the constraints on what can happen inside the region by going to this other non-gravity picture that makes a bit more sense to me.
Okay. Sorry, I had one more question.
Yeah.
What would happen if the points that we picked weren't on the boundary?
Yeah.
Would we then include like, you know, like would you do something with like the path integrals to get like, you know, different potentials, or would it just complicate this?
So yeah, it's a great question. I have a whole paper about it. So you can repeat the story that I'm describing with the points pulled off of the boundary. There's just a few more complications that, like a few more details about how ADS-CFT works that I didn't want to have to take the time to describe in this talk. Basically, what you need, right? So what I used about the points being at the boundary is that it was easy to identify, like if I have this point, which is from the bulk perspective off at the boundary, then I just naturally identify it with some point in the boundary manifold. Right. And I can also say, okay, the same quantum information that's, you know, coming out here is coming out here in the other description. Mm-hmm. If I instead put my point in the interior somewhere, there's still a way of understanding what that means in the conformal field theory or in the boundary perspective. And you just need a few more tools coming from ADS-CFT. Mm-hmm. Specifically, what you need is this idea what's called subregion-subregion duality. So a point here is recorded into not a point in the boundary, but instead a subregion of the boundary. And there's some understanding of, you know, given a subregion in the boundary, how you can do a calculation to determine what part or like what points in the bulk that captures. So given this region in the boundary, there's some portion that it describes. If I chose a point here, and I had some quantum system there, I don't know, A0, then that's going to be recorded like in a sort of non-local way into some large region in the boundary. Okay. So, yeah.
And when you had mentioned, you know, the entropy lower bounds, which I had never seen it done that way before. So it was like very exciting because like, you know, even if you like bring it from just calculation perspective, bring it into like what like cosmology, if you're looking at that, like that's a very interesting constraint to have. Said that there was a 1/2 there, like one half change in entropy.
Yeah.
Is that 1/2 just because of the way you did the calculations, or should we like read into it a little bit more? Like, do you think it could be a little bit more of a generalized we know it's weaker, but is it always going to be 1/2? Like, can we generalize that into, you know, an actual like entropy lower bound?
Is that meaningful?
Going from bulk to boundary? Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. Is that 1/2 that appears meaningful, or is it a limitation of my techniques? Maybe is your
right.
question. So, yes. I suspect that it's a limitation of my techniques. Okay. Yeah, and in particular, I think it means that we should, like, I particularly suspect that because in these kind of non-local games, like if you saturate the natural lower bound on the success probability, then you remove the factor of 1/2 and you get it exactly. So it just would, like getting around this would just involve constructing the right kind of non-local game where you just never do better than randomly guessing, or a sequence of games that converges to that property. So yeah, I think it just raises some interesting questions about these monogamy type games.
Okay. I'm sorry, I have another question, but if someone else has a question, we can I can wait till the end.
I don't see any raised hands. So.
Okay. So it's interesting that you were talking about this today, because yesterday Perimeter had a talk on, somebody gave a talk on quantum network theories. And I've recently been very interested in that, because network theory is very powerful, where there are like a lot, like, you know, you can have a directed graph and you can see like a flow of information or an evolution of a network. And using that in quantum systems sounds very interesting. So do you think that that using some properties of a network theory, since, you know, you define like different points on the boundary, and then you see that on the bulk, and then you see that on the boundary, and you basically created a network with a flow. Have you thought about using some of those properties?
Yeah, so I think that's interesting. Like, so one way to think about what's going on here is there's different, we're doing these information processing tasks. We're doing them in two different perspectives, and the two perspectives have a different, like, causal structure underlying them.
Yes.
So in the bulk, in the example I discussed here, we have a causal structure that looks like this. Mm-hmm. So this was the bulk. And then in the boundary, we had a causal structure that looked like this.
Yeah.
And then the statement that we're thinking about is the fact that you can reproduce everything that happens here in this form, so long as you have a sufficient amount of entanglement between the two sides. And we want to, you know, I was thinking about some detailed things about how much entanglement and things like this. Right. The story is a bit more general than that, though, in that if I think about, like, I could think about more points, I could arrange them differently, so on. And I can get different causal structures in the bulk. So for instance, I could arrange for this causal structure in the bulk, where I have a 3-to-3 process.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the boundary, that that will have some other, like, causal diagram going on. So instead, I might have something like this, where I have all the 2-to-2 interactions.
Right.
Okay. And then what ADS-CFT tells you is that everything you can do in this this kind of a causal structure, you can do in this kind of a causal structure. And then there's a question of, like, what entanglement features do I need to simulate one causal structure with the other, right? And we can both approach that from the perspective of let's use our understanding of quantum information to try and understand that, or we can just look at, well, where is the entanglement in ADS-CFT and what does it tell us it's getting away with using? So yeah, I guess the reason I'm saying this is just that as I go to more complicated examples where these sort of causal graphs are richer, I think bringing in techniques that, like, other people have been thinking about, you know, in the quantum foundations community, in the kind of work you're talking about, could be an interesting, like, set of tools to understand this. But I don't know a ton about it. It's just, you know, something that I've become aware of and I think is interesting.
Yeah, I've used that in something completely different, protein folding, which is biophysics. Yeah. But seeing something like this, it's just like, you know, my brain goes, oh my God, wait, this looks similar to a network that I'm looking, because the points would be the nodes and then the links, the direction forward would be the links, and we can actually weight each link and we can then get features of entanglement. If anything, we could use it to prove or disprove a result. So I thought that was interesting.
You can keep asking questions, but I need to leave and pick up my son from daycare. So my suggestion is whoever who asks the last question, take the role of the chair and then thank Alex and then finish the seminar. Does that sound okay? So I need to leave. Okay.
There is a question from Charlie. Maybe we should switch just for.
Yes.
But yeah, thank you.
I was just wondering if you've thought about the case when you pick points such that the scattering region associated with it is empty. What would that sort of correspond to on the boundary? Like, it feels like the causal structure there would be very strange for on the boundary point of view.
So if the scattering region in the, yeah, so if in the, so you're saying in the bulk, I have this kind of a thing. Then in the boundary, I will have the same set of causal structures or the same causal diagram. And yeah, I don't know. It's just somehow a less interesting situation. Like there's, because there's no discrepancy between the bulk and the boundary, you kind of don't learn anything new, but yeah.
I see. Well, I guess I was just wondering because in that case, you'd imagine it's like a zero area. And so I was wondering what that, so you're just saying it's just two unentangled regions. And so you don't, you just don't really care.
Yeah. I mean, you'll get like a scatter, like you'll get an empty scattering region in the bulk. So there's nowhere to do computations. And then in the boundary, you'll get a very small mutual information between the two corresponding regions.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's consistent in that way, but it's sort of the less interesting case, I suppose.
Yeah, of course. Okay, thank you.
Do we have some more questions? Okay, if not, let's all thank Alex once again for a really nice talk.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for the questions and comments.